tree squirrels are common all through the Midwest, and not just in the woods. You may see tree squirrels in your backyard or in a neighborhood park or on a college campus. If they're not being pests, you probably don't give them much thought. But a century or so ago, squirrels in urban areas were a big novelty, and many saw their presence as a constructive addition to city living. The squirrels in your city may be descendants of ones that were brought in deliberately long ago. I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we talk to ecologist Ed Heskey and historian Etienne Benson about tree squirrels and their habits and how they became a part of urban life. That's coming up on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is my squirrel story. It happened years ago when I lived and worked in Peoria. I was walking one morning on the quad of the Bradley University campus past the university library. At that time, the library building had a small reading room with a door that opened directly out onto the quad. The reading room was empty of people that morning, and the door was propped open due to the heat. But as another passerby pointed out to me, the reading room was not completely empty. A squirrel, being careful to look roundabout for potential dangers, entered the reading room and went over to a candy vending machine. This was not one of today's electronic vending machines, but a completely mechanical one where you pulled a knob to drop a candy bar into a tray. The squirrel jumped onto the tray and then reached up inside the machine to pull down a candy bar, a bit of honey, if I remember correctly. And the squirrel, holding the bit of honey bar in its jaws, ran out of the reading room and up a nearby tree where it enjoyed the candy at its leisure. And that's when I realized there was more going on with squirrels than I had previously thought. We're going to be taking a closer look at squirrels in this hour of Focus. They're common in the Midwest, in both the country and the city, but what sort of creatures are they really? My guests know a thing or two about them. In the studio with me is Ed Heskey, mammalian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, which is part of the Prairie Research Institute at the University of Illinois. Last in our program when we were talking about white nose syndrome among bats some months back. And joining us on the phone is Etienne Benson, assistant professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Professor Benson, welcome to Focus.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And Ed Heskey, welcome back to Focus.
Thank you. Great to be here, too.
And your calls and emails are welcome if you have questions for our guests or a story for our of a squirrel encounter to share. Whether you've seen them do unusual things, made friends with ones, chased them out to out of your garden, perhaps, maybe even hunted and eaten some. Your squirrel stories are welcome at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Now, the behavior I saw with the squirrel that worked the vending machine, that's not something a squirrel living in the deep woods would know about. Maybe this is a question for you, Professor Benson, because you have researched the history of human-squirrel interactions, and I don't mean people going out in the woods and, say, hunting squirrels, but people actually bringing squirrels into urban areas deliberately. How have squirrels adopted living in close quarters with us?
It's a pretty fascinating story. If you look back to the middle of the 19th century, there are very few gray squirrels in the centers of cities, virtually none. And they're, you know, so where are they living? They're living in the deep woods, and in some cases they're living on the margins of cropland. So they're stealing, they might be stealing corn from a farmer, but they're definitely not stealing candy bars from vending machines. But over the course of the, sort of starting in the mid-19th century, people start intentionally introducing them into cities and providing them with houses the same way you might provide birds with birdhouses, providing them with food. And initially very small populations located in small parks in the centers of cities, but then they grow and they expand. And after an initial period of being very dependent on handouts from humans, they learn to exploit all sorts of food sources in the city. And so I think, you know, this maybe actually is a question to throw over to Professor Heskey is why these animals are so adaptable. But I guess, you know, from my research, what I was really interested to find is that they got a lot of help, actually, in making it into this.
Well, I am interested in the fact that people wanted squirrels to come in. They thought squirrels were a valuable addition to the urban landscape. Why was that back in the 19th century?
Well, part of it was certainly part of a broader effort to beautify the city. I think there was a lot of anxiety in the late 19th century about cities as a place of filth, as a place of poverty, as a place that's not very healthy, a place of sickness. And so urban reformers looked around the urban landscape and said, well, why don't we try to bring the healthy aspects of the countryside into the heart of the city? And to do that, they built parks, and people like Frederick Law Olmsted, the landscape architect, were a big part of this, building new parks like Central Park, maybe it's the most famous example in New York, with the idea of creating a healthy landscape so that if you were a worker, let's say working in a dimly lit factory for 12 hours a day or 16 hours a day or however much it might have been, you could go on the weekends and you could take a walk in what was sort of meant to resemble a kind of pastoral scene. And in that context, something like a squirrel was a way of bringing that landscape to life, not just having vegetation, but also having living creatures that at the time were really associated with the countryside, into the heart of the city. That was certainly part of it.
Now, that didn't just happen in big cities like the ones that you write about in your journal article, like Boston and Philadelphia and New York, but even cities here in Champaign-Urbana. Ed Heskey, you were pointing out to me the fact that squirrels were brought on to the University of Illinois campus. They weren't there naturally. They didn't just make their way out of the Deep Grove, or the Big Grove, I guess is the name of the old grove in the Champaign-Urbana area. They were brought in about, 110 years ago?
Yeah. Originally, gray squirrels had a pretty wide distribution in Illinois, but in the pre-settlement times, before European settlement anyway, there was about 15 million acres of forest in Illinois. And gray squirrels at that time were the forest species. They were the ones that liked complete canopy covers and lots of understory and were the much more deep forest species. And the fox squirrels were more in the savannas, open habitat, and along the edges kind of stuff. So by the time the 1900s came, we had reduced the forest in Illinois down to about 4 million acres or less. And as a consequence, gray squirrels were losing ground in terms of both their geographic distribution and their abundance. And not only that, I hope one of our listeners will call in sometime during the call period, because someone once told me that I've never eaten either gray or fox squirrels, but someone who was a hunter once told me that gray squirrels are their preferred species. They taste better. So I hope someone might want to comment on that. But squirrels were hunted also. So they were the gray squirrels took a really big impact on this. And by the 1900s, they were eliminated from a lot of their former range and also areas that had been transferred to agriculture, like the central parts of Illinois. The only place gray squirrels were left were in some of the big river systems. And so they were missing from the urban areas and some places they had been before. I have an article here that I took off the University of Illinois website, but that sums it up pretty good. But basically, around 1901, there was a president of the University of Illinois named Andrew Draper, and he worked together with a professor from the geology department named Charles Rolfe, and they decided they wanted to introduce gray squirrels to the U of I campus as a way of enhancing campus life for the students. And the president at that time said, this will be great for the students. They'll learn to be nice to animals, and they'll take this spiritual enhancement out with them for the rest of their lives. And so he wrote a letter to the Board of Regents requesting $250 to bring squirrels onto campus, and apparently they housed them in a cages for breeding and display purposes on the lawn of the campus, and I'm sure since then they were released and escaped. But this, of course, raised a furor in the local community and in the newspapers, who basically said a waste of taxpayer money, you know, to introduce squirrels on campus. But the squirrels we have on campus now, and probably the squirrels in Champaign, are likely descendants of this introduction.
Now, this is something, and let me throw this back to you, Professor Benson.
These squirrels are not native to urban areas. The gray squirrel is used to a thick forest. And I gather also they really need trees that can give them something to eat year-round. How do they do in urban areas as far as getting around? You mentioned that I believe they were initially essentially housed and fed, but these days squirrels seem to do okay on their own. How have they adapted to urban life?
Yeah, the story about the introduction of squirrels to the campus is one that I've seen elsewhere as well, and it's definitely true that at the beginning, the people who introduced these squirrels, so for instance, Harvard also has squirrels on its campus around 1901, 1902. Columbia also introduces them to its campus. And initially, everybody thinks these animals are not going to survive the winter because they're in an urban environment that just doesn't have food for squirrels. And so they spend money to provide winter food. So Harvard, for instance, has a couple of big bags of peanuts that one of the day watchmen on campus hands out to the squirrels in the winter months. Around 1907, a Harvard professor organizes a bunch of children living in the western part of the state where there are more acorns to gather acorns, and those he has those brought probably by train back to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where they get distributed to the squirrels. So the people who are introducing these animals at the beginning didn't think that they could survive on their own without feeding. And next to these big, what you might call institutional efforts to feed squirrels, there, of course, were also individual people feeding them. This was one of the things that made it fun to have them around, which was that you could engage in this act of feeding the animal. The squirrels would approach you, look like they were begging for food. You could feed them. You could play with them. And that was a big part of the appeal. So initially, there was a lot of focus on intentionally feeding them. But of course, it became apparent quite quickly, actually, I would say, by the first decade of the 20th century, that squirrels were pretty good at finding sources of food on their own once they had a foothold in the city.
So where are they finding the food?
Well, part of it is from trees. So, you know, if the late 19th century, there's a big tree planting. There's a couple things that happen. One is a big tree planting movement in urban areas, and it's connected to the whole idea of beautifying the city. So all of a sudden you have tree-lined avenues in cities, you have parks full of trees. You also have the suburbanization of the city, you might call it. So as cities spread out, there's more and more houses that are built on, you know, kind of standalone houses surrounded by a garden or by trees. And this starts to provide more of the kind of food that a squirrel might live on in the woods, things like acorns, things like buds that appear on trees in the spring. And then, of course, there's garbage, and that is not a new thing to the beginning of the 20th century, but it is new for the squirrels to find it as a source to exploit.
Eating garbage, are they eating food that's similar to what they would get in the wild, that is grain or nuts, or are they finding other foods that they wouldn't normally eat?
I think all many of us who spend time on college campuses had the experience of going to throw something out in a trash can and finding a squirrel jumping out of it, looking slightly offended that we've interrupted its meal.
Is that the case here at the U of I yet?
Yeah, squirrels are really opportunistic. They'll eat pretty much anything. Now, to say they'll eat pretty much anything doesn't do justice to their diet, because they do have things they specialize on. And as Etienne pointed out, they specialize on hard mast. They love to have acorns. They love to have hickory nuts. They love to have walnuts, beech nuts, things along those lines. And where those forests occur is where the squirrels reach their highest numbers, and that's their best diet. And the reason is a couple of things. Those things can be cached and stored over the winter when other foods aren't available, so they depend on those. And also, squirrels' front teeth, like all rodents, grow without stopping. And if they don't have something hard to gnaw on to wear them down, those teeth will grow and to the point where they kill the squirrel, inhibit it so it can't chew function. So if they're eating pizza crusts and stuff like that, they're getting stuff that's not really that nutritious for them, just like humans aren't. And also, it doesn't really wear down their teeth. So they have to also have hard foods that they can gnaw on, or else they'll just kind of gnaw on wood or whatever. But as ATN pointed out too, around town, on campus, for example, we do have a lot of oak trees and some walnut trees, But they'll supplement their diet with all kinds of things. They'll eat tree buds and stuff, particularly in the spring when there's not much other food around, and they'll strip bark and eat the phloem underneath that. They'll eat insects sometimes. In the springs, they'll try to eat bird eggs. They'll do all kinds of various things to supplement their diet, and they're really good at finding some resource somewhere, even if it's just something that provides energy, like a pizza crust.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We are talking about squirrels and their secrets and their history with humans. My guests are ecologist Ed Heskey of the Illinois Natural History Survey and history professor at the N. Benson from the University of Pennsylvania. And you can join the discussion as well. You can have send us your squirrel stories or questions. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. And the phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. And besides phone or email, you can send your questions or comments to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Now, I think, Professor Benson, we're talking about squirrels that are imported into urban areas. Are they usually gray squirrels?
Yeah, so I think there are two species that tend to live in urban areas, the fox squirrel and the gray squirrel. On the East Coast, it's just the gray squirrel. If you look back at when I've looked back at sources from the early period, from the 19th century, let's say, you might find also reports of red squirrels, the American red squirrel or pine squirrel, around urban areas or on the outskirts. But it's really the gray squirrel that's ended up dominating. And I think that's partly because they're very adaptable, partly because they're not very territorial. It's easy for gray squirrels to build up to kind of fairly dense concentrations without a lot of fighting, or at least not as much fighting as you might find among red squirrels. What's interesting, and this is something that I actually haven't focused on quite as much because my own focus was largely on the East Coast. In the Midwest, there are more of this other species, the fox squirrel, which is slightly larger, usually a little bit more reddish. I think spends a little bit more time on the ground rather than in trees in comparison to the gray squirrel, but in many ways it's fairly similar.
Well, Ed, what squirrels are we seeing here in Champaign-Urbana, Champaign County, Central Illinois?
If you're in the towns, if you're in Champaign, if you're in Rantoul, if you're in St. Joe, if you're in Mahomet, if you're in Gibson City, Melvin, you'll see gray squirrels. But once you get outside, everything else is fox squirrels. And the only place you'll see gray squirrels in central Illinois, around this area, is I think there's some along the Vermilion River south of Danville, and there's some over around Allerton Park along the Sangamon.
As far as gray squirrels outside of urban areas.
Right. The rest of the time, it's hit and miss in the towns all around here. The ones I mentioned are the ones that I know have gray squirrels. Most of the other ones actually have fox squirrels. So either squirrel can live in town areas. And in Chicago, you have a mix of both squirrels right in Chicago. And there's a person up there, Joel Brown, at the University of Illinois in Chicago, who's got a public science program going on where people call in and report squirrels in their neighborhoods. And he's got maps of all the neighborhoods of Chicago and which ones have fox and which ones have red squirrels. Fox squirrels or gray squirrels. And it's kind of a patchwork. You either have one or the other usually. And Joel has correlated it with the density of pets. He thinks that in Chicago, at least, that fox squirrels are better at avoiding dogs and cats than gray squirrels. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, that's his correlation from Chicago. Down here, it seems to be a town either has one or the other.
Let me take a call now. Line 4, Sarah from Urbana, good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. I was just walking my dog beside Everett Lab on Wright Street. She started poking in undisturbed snow. I saw gray fur, and she poked some more, and a squirrel just leapt up and ran up a tree. So it looked like the squirrel was hibernating. I had never heard of such activity.
Now, that's something I was wondering about, Ed, because my neighborhood has a fair amount of squirrels, but when the snow falls, they just sort of disappear until the snow goes away or starts to melt. As far as I can tell, where do the squirrels go? And is the squirrel that Sarah called Sarah saw, is the squirrel behaving the sort of way that you expect when snow falls.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation. Thanks for sharing that, because as far as I know, there are no reports of gray squirrels hibernating on the ground. First of all, they don't hibernate. There's three kinds of squirrels in the squirrel family. If we have time later on, I can talk about general squirrel biology. But there's tree squirrels, there's gliding squirrels, and there's ground squirrels. And only ground squirrels hibernate. Tree squirrels and gray squirrels do not hibernate. They're
and ground squirrels are like chipmunks and woodchucks. Right. You may not think of them as squirrels per se, but they're in that order of animals.
Right. We have 13 line ground squirrels and Franklin's ground squirrels. People might be more associated with two. But anyway, I've heard a couple of stories of occasionally a red squirrel having a ground burrow, but gray squirrels are arboreal, and they'll have nests in tree cavities as their preferred choice. But around here, we don't have a lot of old trees with mature trees with a lot of cavities. So as you're walking around town, you'll see these balls of leaves up in the trees this time of year. And those are gray squirrel nests. They're called dray nests, D-R-E-Y nests. And what the squirrel does is it makes a little, sometimes it'll take over a crow nest, or a lot of times it'll just build a little platform out of twigs and things up there, and then start putting on a bed of material it will collect. It will collect grass, it will collect leaves that it will shred finely, it will collect other vegetation that it will bark that it will shred finely. And it will also collect material from people. If you leave a rug out in your porch or a pillow or a cushion, sometimes they'll tear into those and steal material. And they'll make a nest that has an interior lining that's really tightly woven and kind of windproof and kind of weatherproof in there. And then outside of that will be a layer of more coarser leaves and twigs, and that's what you see from the outside. So it looks like a flimsy big thing from the outside, but the inside is actually fairly stable and
this sounds like a fairly sophisticated structure for an animal to make.
Mm-hmm. Well, animals make sophisticated structures.
Professor Benson, I'm wondering, as people brought squirrels in the cities and they thought that they had to help them out, were they concerned about how they fared during the winter?
Yeah, they were. And this explains, I think, both the feeding and also the construction of houses, which it sounds like there were houses on campus and there at the University of Illinois, also houses in various other places. At some point around the first decade of the 20th century, there was a subscription raised to build new houses for squirrels in Central Park out of concern that they were not finding places where they could survive the winters. Mm-hmm. Of course, we know now that they are capable of doing this on their own as well. I wanted to add something on the subject of predators, which Ed mentioned earlier, and particularly pets. When squirrels were initially introduced to American cities, there were a lot more what we would call stray pets, stray animals on the streets than I think we're now used to in most American cities. A lot more cats, a lot more dogs running freely. And the people who introduced squirrels knew that these animals were predators that posed some kind of threat to the squirrels, particularly cats. And there's a very interesting rhetoric at the time that develops. So Ed also mentioned in Illinois this idea that introducing squirrels would have some kind of moral impact on students on campus, on people in general. And I think that moral impact had a lot to do with ideas about charity and compassion and trust. So could you learn to be charitable to a vulnerable animal, small, vulnerable, needy animal? Would that compassion that you developed and that practice in charity be generalizable to other kinds of vulnerable beings, vulnerable people? And I think that was some of the logic behind it. And in that context, if you think about community as building these relationships of trust and charity and compassion, when you introduce something like a cat, whose main goal is not to be charitable to squirrels, you might say, that threatens to undermine that whole system. And so there's a lot of language that is very critical about both humans and animals who would pose a threat to the lives of the squirrels in the city, because they undermine this whole idea of trust, right? That you would feed a squirrel and it would slowly over time learn to trust you and to take food from you.
A lot of moral questions, ethical questions going on there with human-squirrel relationships. I want to go back to Sarah for just a moment and who we have just lost, but let's see if I can pose the question back to Ed. This was a squirrel that popped out of the snow. Would they be burrowing down there on the ground in the winter? Would they Is there perhaps a cavity that that the grass and underbrush might create where they could move about?
Mm-hmm. That's a question I can't really answer. I mean, there are animals that do go down to the ground in the winter. Surprising to some people, red bats in Arkansas, when it gets real cold, will go down and just burrow into the leaf litter. But I've never heard of squirrels doing that. Now, squirrels do have acorns buried and or other kind of food kind of buried down there. And it may have gone down someplace where she didn't see the hole and be down there trying to find something. Usually they're not completely buried so much like that. I saw a squirrel just yesterday after that we had our 3 inches of snow in Champaign. I was pretty hungry out in the yard around the Natural History Survey, just diving into the snow, burying its head, going down underneath and searching for something and popping up and looking around and diving down again. So it might have just been foraging and she didn't see it go down in, under a deep area. But I've never heard of anything actually staying on the ground like that.
Let me take a call, another caller now. Line one, this is Eric in Urbana, and this might actually relate to the foraging issue. Eric, you're on the air on Focus.
Okay, yeah, I've got a squirrel story. They're pretty intelligent. A squirrel found like a kind of a big nut, or it had a big shell on it. So he carried it over to a car in my driveway and put it under the tire. Then he covered it with leaves, so when the car backed up, it would break the shell, and I concluded the reason he put leaves on it was so it wouldn't have any dirt from the tire on the nut itself. So I thought that was pretty smart.
Well, if that was the squirrel's motivation, that was pretty smart. I'd be surprised if it was actually thinking that far ahead, but, you know, I don't know. They surprise you. To me, squirrels, particularly in the fall, they're doing all sorts of caching of hard mast. And this can be acorns or like a nut like you described. And it would put leaves over it to hide it because it doesn't want other squirrels to see it or whatever other animals might be out there that could exploit that stuff. In some places, birds eat acorns, for example. So squirrels have all kinds of things that they do when they're hiding their food. And sometimes they'll put something in one place, then they'll come back later and pick it up again and move it to a better place. And they're all constantly moving around the things that they hide. And they even have strange little behaviors they'll do. If a squirrel knows that other squirrels are around watching it and it has a good acorn, it'll look around, it'll pretend it digs a hole and puts the acorn in, but really not, and hide the acorn's mouth, then move on to someplace else, pretend to dig another one and look around, and then finally hide the acorn someplace after it's confused whoever's watching it by false caches and stuff. So,
well, that's interesting.
They
right
do a
there,
lot like that, yeah.
Because I'm wondering if a squirrel can think ahead enough to go through the behavior of pretending but not really burying an acorn. Then if a squirrel sees cars move and maybe has seen the consequences of cars moving over a nut before, could they have the learned behavior of putting a nut next to a tire knowing that sooner or later that car will move and crush the nut?
Yeah, I can't answer that, but I would be really surprised if they were that smart. But who am I to say the squirrel's not smart?
Yeah. I mean, if I can jump in, from what I've also read, squirrels are quite sensitive to, you know, the presence of other creatures that might know where their nuts are. Their ability to think ahead and make plans is not necessarily so well developed. But it is possible to imagine, I think, that a squirrel could over time develop an association between caching nuts on a driveway and finding later that those nuts were split open. Now, whether or not the squirrel would think that's a good thing, actually, for the nut to be split open is another question.
Yeah.
It's certainly possible that they could learn over time that in certain places, when they cache nuts, certain kinds of consequences follow.
Yeah, see, I would say that that's not an important thing to a squirrel. And the reason is they have great equipment. Their front teeth are superbly designed to to open up nuts and things like that. And they don't have any trouble opening them. If anything, if they're caching something, they want to save it for later. And I'm not sure that they would go that. It would be worth, if they can open up walnuts, I've seen squirrels open up coconuts. You know, I don't think they need something to crack a nut for them.
Well, I don't know. This could be somebody's very valuable research project here.
It could be. You want to do a master's project?
Eric, thank you very much for calling. And I also wanted to thank Sarah for calling earlier as well. Let's take a short break now. And we'll be back with more talk about squirrels and what they do when humans are around. This is Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Our lawn and garden advice show usually airs on a Friday, and I want to give you a heads up that due to scheduling complications, we'll be doing the next lawn and garden edition of Focus this coming Tuesday. Topics will include giving new life to houseplants over the winter and growing herbs indoors and year-round, plus all your lawn, garden, and indoor plant questions will be welcome on the Tuesday edition of Focus. Right now, we are talking about squirrels, tree squirrels, the bushy-tailed rodents you may have taken for granted. My guests today are ecologist Ed Heskey of the Illinois Natural History Survey, which is a part of the Prairie Research Institute at the U of I, and history professor Etienne Benson from the University of Pennsylvania at Philadelphia. Between them, they cover a lot of ground about squirrels and human-squirrel relations. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580, and the phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. And Professor Benson, I wanted to get back to what you spoke about how it was seen when squirrels were brought in the cities in the 19th century, that having this relationship between humans and squirrels would be a good thing, that it could be a good for moral development, perhaps for children, as they learn to, to help squirrels, to help a creature that's more vulnerable than they are. And at the same time, are squirrels really that innocent and vulnerable?
Yeah, this was actually the thing, as I started digging through old newspaper articles and family magazines and all sorts of sources from the late 19th and early 20th century, this that had to do with squirrels. The thing that really surprised me the most, I think, was the emphasis on moral development and education. So this is somewhat separate from what I had described earlier, this desire to bring a little bit of nature into the city. This is really about developing good character in urban residents. And you see it even in coming from it's not just a rhetoric on the margins. So this is not just something that shows up in children's magazines. This shows up in mainstream publications of all kinds. And it comes from presidents of universities as well as from, children's literature authors. One of my favorite sources actually comes from Thompson Seton, who was a Canadian-American nature writer. And he... who wrote a lot of very popular books about animals around the turn of the 20th century. And he was also one of the people who led to the development of the Boy Scouts in the U.S. and was, in fact, the chief Boy Scout for a few years around the beginning of the 20th century. And he actually wrote an article published in Boy's Life, the Boy Scout magazine, arguing for the introduction of what he called missionary squirrels to American cities. And the idea there was that by introducing squirrels to cities and by teaching young boys in particular that it was more fun to feed them and to play with them than it was to hunt them or kill them or torture them or what have you, you could actually make a real difference in the kind of moral character of American boyhood, of American youth.
We seem to have moved away from that, at least in that sort of level of the virtues of humans helping animals.
Yeah. Can I add something to that?
Yeah.
That was around the period that Adrian's talking about. That was real important. But as you noted, there's other reasons people introduce squirrels, and in more recent years, there's been several introductions in Illinois that are examples of that. Some of the introductions in gray squirrels to the towns around here, for example, are just people wanting to restore something they were familiar with from their youth, or something that they thought would enhance the aesthetics. But gray squirrels, in particular, show an interesting phenomenon, is that they have a lot of variation in their coat color. We call them gray squirrels, but there's some that are really melanistic or really black, dark. And then there's a couple of places where there are white squirrels.
The city of Olney, a few miles from here, is famous for their white. They're actually albino gray squirrels, aren't they?
Right. They whether they're albinos or not is questionable, because albinism is a recessive gene that basically has a lot of other consequences besides white coat color. And albinos typically have red eyes because their irises have no pigment, and they have really poor vision, and they're very not good survivors. Every time I've seen an albino's I've seen an albino gray squirrel around town. I've seen an albino Franklin's ground squirrel, albino 13 lions, and they never live long. But the squirrels that only have have bluish eyes and stuff, so they're not complete albinos. And there's another population of white squirrels in Missouri. Those are the only two I know of with whites. But there's lots of populations of black squirrels also. And ATN's probably familiar with that. There was an introduction.
Black squirrels being a breed of squirrels or
no,
just a
it's
color?
No, it's just gray squirrels.
That happen to be black.
I'd have to give you a biology lesson of what causes coat color in squirrels. But let's just say that there are some gray squirrels that have really dark fur, black.
Okay.
And, for example, a population of those was introduced to Washington, D.C. from Canada just for the novelty. And the population in Olney was introduced there also. There's a couple of different stories about how it came there. One story is that a trapper got two of them from the Wabash area and brought them in and housed them, and then they eventually escaped. Another story says they were brought into a bar, into a saloon, and kept in a cage there as a novelty, and then someone who felt sorry for the squirrel snuck in and released them, and then once they're out in the town just adopted them and protected them, and eventually there were several hundred of them. But basically, I don't know how good they're doing now, because in the 90s I went down to Olney to look at these squirrels, and I could only find two driving around town.
Well, I know that at least online the city is still promoting its white squirrels, and you'll just have to go down there to see sometime.
Right.
We have our switchboard lighting up with callers with things to say about squirrels. Let me go to line two. Marlene from Urbana, good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi, thank you. This is so fascinating because I have been watching squirrels in my backyard for 5 years. Anyway, I have an interest in how they build these nests and, you know, whether they're communal or not with families in the same tree. Right now, I have a magnolia tree outside my yard that has five squirrel nests, and I have an architect squirrel, I believe, because he has built a double story, almost triple story nest, where one nest is on top of the other within just an inch of each other. And I'm wondering if this is typical and why they would do that.
Ed?
Okay.
You got an answer for that one?
Yeah, no, smiling. It's again, reading the mind of a squirrel. it's like they do crazy things. No, squirrels are not, tree squirrels at least, are not social. Flying squirrels will form aggregations in the winter where there'll be a dozen or more in a tree cavity or a nest box in the winter. But gray squirrels and fox squirrels don't do that. They're basically solitary. During some times of the year, the female will share a nest with her recent young. But when it's time for them to disperse, they all have to go off on their own and make their own nests. There may be an occasional time where a couple of squirrels might share a nest during really cold times in the winter or something. But for the most part, it's one nest, one squirrel. And the architect squirrel, it's hard to say. Maybe the first nest he built wasn't working out. It was leaking. There was air in it. It wasn't windproof or something. Or maybe it collapsed somehow, and he built another one on top of it.
Some brother and sister squirrels are perhaps just living all in the same tree.
That could happen, because I've seen.
Would they tolerate each other?
The thing about tree squirrels, particularly, is that red squirrels, for example, are strongly territorial, but gray squirrels and fox squirrels are not. So their home ranges, the areas that they use, will overlap extensively. And they might be aggressive right around a nest that they have and some personal space issues, and while they're foraging in a good area, they'll have some aggressive interactions, but they don't defend territories. And particularly in these urban areas, I've seen, like our caller, you know, in my yard, you know, several, three or four animals that look to me about the same size, and they're small. They may be litter mates or something like that, and they'll all still be in the same area where they were born. And so it's not unlikely that you could get an aggregation of that, especially if good trees for building nests in it are limited. But they don't form social groups, and they don't share nests.
Okay. Marlene, thank you very much for the call. Let me go on to another caller on line four, and that is David from Atwood. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, will a gray squirrel and a red squirrel breed with each other? And the second question is, once they're living, how far will they roam around? Will they move 2 or 3 miles, 10 miles? I live out in the country. I just wondered how far they would roam.
Okay. Well, David, thank you very much for the call. First of all, red squirrels and gray squirrels. do different, they're different species, aren't they?
Right.
Can they? Are they close enough to breed?
No. I would reply to the caller. First of all, I'd just like to clarify. I think that the caller means gray squirrels and fox squirrels, not the red squirrels. The red squirrels are the red squirrels are about half the size of a gray squirrel. They're really aggressive and noisy, live more in conifer forests, make big middens and stuff. And these aren't the ones around here. But the fox squirrels we have here are reddish colored. So they're called fox squirrels because they've got an orangish red belly, orangish red tinge to their tail.
Are they about the same size as a gray squirrel?
No, a gray squirrel weighs about 300 to 700 grams. So that's about 1.25 pounds, say. A fox squirrel is almost twice as big. Their body ranges from about 500 to 1,300 grams. So they're about twice as big, 1.5 to 2 times as big as a gray squirrel.
But would they also ever interbreed?
As far as we know, no. Sometimes you see gray squirrels that look like they have a reddish tinge to them. Particularly their summer pelage on the sides sometimes will have a reddish tinge. But the people who have tried to do some genetic studies to look at it have never found interbreeding. That doesn't mean that it occurs maybe now and then and we haven't seen it, but it would be as unlikely as a dog and a wolf. You know, they're kind of like different in their size and in their aggressiveness in some of the habitats they use.
And so not even as much as we've certainly seen not dogs and wolves, but coy dogs, coyotes,
right,
and dogs, but not that sort of thing, right, going on with say, fox and gray squirrels.
Right. I'm not aware of an intensive study that has really examined it, but I've seen that question asked in the literature, do they interbreed? And the people who have tried to look at it genetically have never found it. So I'm saying unlikely.
Okay.
Not.
How far does a squirrel roam? I mean, if you have one squirrel, the squirrel has a litter, the squirrels grow up, they go out looking for greener pastures, how far are they going to go? Yeah.
This is a really interesting question because there's not like an answer I can say like 1 mile. The answer is there's a really range of home range sizes that have been studied. They can be from less than a hectare, which is, maybe an urban squirrel has a really small home range, to a country squirrel, which might roam an area that's maybe about 20 hectares maximum.
And that's just in the course of a day of looking for foraging for food.
No, that's in the course of their life. That's their range. But squirrels disperse. They move, too. Young squirrels have to leave their home. And there's a really interesting difference, if we have a few minutes. Do we? I see you're looking at the microphone.
We better keep it quick. Okay. We have more calls waiting.
All right. Gray squirrels and fox squirrels. One of the reasons that we have fox squirrels all over the countryside on here and not grays is because they have really different dispersal abilities. I had a student who did an experiment where he put radio collars on gray and fox squirrels and put them in a tree line over near Sydney and let them run around the country. And basically, within the first 30 days, gray squirrels had less daily movements, less far movements as fox squirrels, and a fox squirrel got as far as about 3 miles away to find some forest, whereas gray squirrels never got more than a mile or so.
Professor Benson, in the 19th century, when people were bringing squirrels into parks and giving them special food supplies and special houses, did they find that the squirrels were going outside of the parks, or were they just staying put?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I found sources. So this actually goes back to the question about black squirrels in a way. When black squirrels were introduced to Washington, D.C. Around 1903, it became very easy to track how far they were moving, right, because they looked different than the other squirrels. And so they were initially released in Rock Creek Park around the National Zoo. And it took them, even though a squirrel can disperse on its own for a mile or two, it took them quite a while, actually, to move out. So it took probably a couple of decades for those black squirrels to move as far as Bethesda, which is on the outskirts of Washington, D.C., which is a couple of, a few miles. Mm. And the reason was, I think, that they had lots of good habitat in the intervening spaces, so they didn't have to move that far. Mm. But they certainly did eventually spread quite a distance.
And that's exactly right, because one of the reasons the squirrels out here move so far is because the forest patches are so far between. They've got to cross that intervening area to get to the next good habitat. If you had good habitat close by, you wouldn't need to move that far.
Let me go ahead and take another caller, and this is Jack from Gainesville, Florida. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. Been a really interesting discussion, and I don't know how interesting this bit will be, but I actually grew up in a little town in Kansas, And it was really surprised me when I first saw squirrels in a city setting because they were so tiny. I remember squirrels being the size of small dogs sometimes. And people who've grown up in cities look at me like I'm a weirdo when I tell them that I've eaten squirrel. But out there, I mean, it actually, you could, you know, you can hunt squirrel and have a pretty good meal off of it. And now that I'm down here in Gainesville, Florida, they're even they're basically glorified rats. They're not really much of a squirrel. So I just thought I'd throw that into the discussion.
How does squirrel taste?
Really good. I mean, it's greasy, but you know, what really surprised me was how tough the hide was when we skinned it. It's a tougher hide than deer even sometimes. So that was one really surprising thing. But yeah, it was as we say in Kansas, it was good eating. So.
Okay.
Thank you,
Jack. Thank you very much for calling. I think we have another caller who's eating some squirrel. Let me go to line one, Rick from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Yeah, I say both fox squirrels and gray squirrels are very fine eating, and I disagree a little. I don't think they're greasy at all. Really, they don't get much fat going, especially not like a possum or something like that. But my main concern is sort of the premise here in Champaign-Urbana with the introduction of the gray squirrels. Just because that happened, I wonder if that doesn't mean that the gray squirrels weren't already here, you know, with the big grove and large area of forested land.
I don't know.
I wonder if there's any more documentation or anything like that, yeah, besides just the one instance.
No, thanks for bringing that up. A lot of people don't realize that there was an area right here around the Champaign area called Big Grove. It was, I've looked on maps. I've tried to see how big it was, but I've looked on some old maps from the 1800s, and it is an area that's kind of a circular blob about 2 miles in diameter. So it's a pretty big thing, and it occurred from like northeast Urbana off in that direction. So the town was kind of like on the edge of it. In fact, Urbana's original name was Big Grove, named after the forest.
And I think the U of I owns some stands of land out northeast of Urbana, which I guess are part of that original big
Brownfield Woods and Trelease Woods, for example. But there were gray squirrels in that forest, and when I say that there were none in this area, there may still have been some in Big Grove. That's a good point. There weren't any in the town of Champaign and on the university campus at the time of the introductions. And the squirrels that were introduced were not brought from Big Grove. They were actually brought from another urban area. I don't know exactly where, but they were brought.
Squirrels that already knew the territory as far as urban living.
It was assumed that the introduction should be of squirrels that were kind of domesticated already. So that introduction did occur. And whether or not all the squirrels here now are from those, or it's a mix, is a good point, and I'm not sure how to get at that answer without genetics or something, but that is a possibility, so thanks for bringing that up.
Rick, thank you very much for the call. We just have about a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to get a question in that came in over email, and this comes from Joanne, who says that, Ed, you may have partially answered this question with your comment about squirrels needing to eat hard-shelled nuts to keep their teeth from growing too far. Why do they chew plastic? Joanne writes, they chewed the handle off my bird bath brush, the knobs off my gas grill, the screw knob on the table's umbrella pole. They steal the plastic rain gauge tubes and chew them, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I had seen where I lived, evidence that some of the plastic garbage cans had been chewed on, but I always thought the squirrels are animals that did that, were just trying to get into whatever was inside. This just sounds like chewing to be chewing.
Well, once again, what's in the mind of the squirrel when he does it? I don't know. It could be chewing just to be chewing, but it also just could be trying out something that smells interesting. I mean, we also know, that squirrels get into trouble by chewing on electrical wires. They used to cause a lot of trouble when we had transformers on telephone poles. They would get into them and cache nuts up there and sometimes chew on a wire and cause a power outage. I'm sure you can have a caller call in and say one got into his car in the winter and chewed on an electrical wire in his car or on a hose in his car and caused car damage. There's lots of reports of them doing that. I think that plastics, petroleum products, things like that, they have a smell that might be interesting, and the squirrels are always looking for new food sources. They're always hungry, and they're sampling.
Okay. Just about 30 seconds to go, Professor Benson. I wanted to get another question over to you. After all that interest in the 19th century and the early 20th century of getting squirrels into urban areas, do all urban areas across the country have squirrels now?
No, not all of them. But what is striking is that even areas, urban areas that are far outside of the gray squirrel's original native range now have squirrels. So, you know, originally gray squirrels were native to eastern North America. You can now find them in Seattle, in Vancouver. You can find them in London. You can find them in Italy. You can find them in South Africa. At one point, you could find them in Australia, though I think that population has died out. So at some point, these animals, for the same reasons, to beautify the city, to teach children how to be kind to the vulnerable, to provide entertainment, for all sorts of reasons, these animals were introduced all over the place, even to environments very, very different from where they were originally found.
Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of Focus, devoted to the not-so-common tree squirrel. My thanks to Ed Heskey, mammalian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, part of the Prairie Research Institute at the U of I. And thanks also to you, Professor Etienne Benson, with the Department of History at the University of Pennsylvania. And thanks to everyone who called or emailed questions, and our apologies to anyone who didn't make it to the air. We invite you to continue the discussion on today's program at www.will.illinois.edu/focus. This is Focus on WILL.